Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
We are listening to the choral group Roomful of Teeth. They are eight vocalists who experiment with sound and what's possible with the human voice. And they've studied techniques from around the world, like Tuvan throat singing, Korean pansuri, and yodeling, like in the song we're hearing, Rinde Eckart's Seska's View. Brad Wells is the founder and artistic director of Roomful of Teeth. He also teaches at Williams College. He says a lot goes into creating a composition like this one.
The singers in the group and I, we meet with singers from other singing traditions. The group is classically trained, and we, for instance, spend a week with a master yodeler, and he gets everybody to gain some degree of facility with yodeling. How does that feel to move the voice in these particular ways? What comes up then? And then composers who are listening in start to write for the group, knowing that some of those sounds start to become accessible.
Yodeling comes from a number of cultures. Lots of people, when their kids try it, right? Everybody, because they saw Sound of Music, tried at one point in their lives
right.
to yodel. And yet, these are incredibly difficult vocal techniques. Can any singer learn to do this? Or have you put together a group of eight singers who really are weirdly good at trying these kinds of new and challenging techniques?
I think it's both. I mean, some of them aren't difficult. When I work with my students at my college, I'll say even my dog, actually, sometimes when she howls, her voice does a kind of yodel break.
So I'm the only one who can't. Your dog can do it, but I can't.
Hey, come spend some time with us, sweetie. We will get you yodeling. And actually, one of the surprising things about some of these worlds that we swim in, singing-wise, the more it might point to a developed skill. It's like you think of if you're a swimmer and your muscles develop over many, many years in a particular way, you're using your body in that way, and then you try to go and throw a discus. It might be harder for you to go from no experience throwing the discus to being pretty good versus somebody who is not a master swimmer and hasn't developed muscles that might be. And I'm of course making this up. I have no idea what the fact is. But with singing and yodeling, some of our singers who have worked years to smooth out breaks, for instance, have had a harder time entering that. It's just a muscle switch that they have to find. It's coordination.
Listeners who would come to you today, I think, would think of you as cutting edge. And yet you have been around 10, 11 years. You formed the group in 2008. What was the landscape at the time, and what made you want to do this 11 years ago?
I started thinking about a project along these lines back in the 80s and 90s.
So a long time ago.
A long time ago. And one sort of initial seed for my thinking was studying classical voice in college, being interested in new music and new art, finding how the voice is used by composers in the 60s, 70s, early 80s, and there being sort of two streams in the classical art world. One was sort of conventional opera singers, what you would expect to hear on any opera house around the world, or super crazy, crazy weird, where a sneeze or a laugh or a giggle is as legitimate material for the composer as a beautiful singing tone. I thought that was interesting, but I also never found any emotional response to a sneeze or a throat clearing. There's nothing in that material that developed around emotion and heightened communication, which is what singing is. So when I started to hear singers like Meredith Monk, who's this not classically trained composer, she's making music with her voice and with the voices in her group that's much rawer and simpler, and in some ways is more like a group of folk singers who got together but were willing to kind of think more outside the box than categories of folk music or pop music or rock music or jazz. Like, what's possible? What other beautiful worlds can be created? The next big sort of aha was the Bulgarian women's choir recordings that were coming out on Nonesuch in the late 80s and 90s. And this bright front kind of belty sound that for most classical voice teachers, they'd say, don't go close to that. Like, you're gonna shred your voice.
Oh, so you hear that sound and you think, we need more of that? We need more people pushing the boundaries vocally or changing what we consider to be what we should be training in?
So it's two things. I mean, one thing, I hear that, and at first I think, oh, danger, danger, don't do that. And then I think, oh, but I'm feeling stuff that I have never felt in classical music, in contemporary classical music. Just from the color of the voices, collective voices there, I'm feeling stuff. It's a color that evokes a world of emotions that we don't have access to the same way with the voice in this more rounded, resonant, deep place.
Let's listen to some other music here. Caroline Shaw, a mezzo-soprano in the group, won the Pulitzer Prize for Partita for Eight Voices, which you performed. Let's hear it. First, there are a couple of things in there that almost sound vocally impossible, right? There's growling, and there's high, and there's low. The other thing that's remarkable about it is that's eight people, which then makes one wonder, and maybe this is a silly question, is there some magical number about eight? Like, could you do something with eight that was different than four or 12, or was it randomly eight? How much does how many people are performing together matter for the kind of sound you're trying to create?
I don't think number matters at all.
So how did you wind up where you are?
It's all I could afford.
I love practical answers like that. Yeah. So if you were 30, you could do the same thing. And if you were 2, you could do the same thing.
Sure.
So I do want to stay with Partita for Eight Voices for a minute. This month you received some pushback on Twitter from someone from an indigenous community. There's a Inuit throat singing technique in that piece. They took issue with your use of the technique and that no Inuits were named as composers or were hired. Your group went on to release a statement saying that you, quote, support the important work of Indigenous resurgence, end quote, and will immediately, quote, find opportunities to amplify and support performing artists, end quote, in Indigenous communities. How are you thinking about doing that?
We are actively reaching out to lots of people we know and people who friends of ours know in Canada and in Inuit communities to figure out where the places are that we can look and develop a relationship and support in all those ways that we stated.
And you've studied a wide variety of techniques from different cultures, different countries. Has receiving this criticism changed how you're thinking about your experimentation and your use of different styles and your learning of different styles? How are you thinking about that now?
It hasn't changed it at all, but I think it's helping clarify what the project is about and also where to be alert for how singing is held in communities. And I think it's, you know, it varies all over the world. We were talking about yodeling before. Yodeling has emerged in so many different singing cultures that it doesn't, you think, well, what's the singing? Is there any culture that has rights to yodeling, if there were any? I mean, we could jokingly say, yeah, Switzerland or, you know, the Alpine communities of Europe. But that makes no sense. It happens in so many different places around the world. But other singing traditions, for a number of reasons, might have a kind of potential or might situate relative to the identity of that culture in such a way that we need to be incredibly respectful and if we're to engage, if we're to, you know, study or converse or even listen to and be affected by, we need to be aware of those forces. One thing that we were talking about, including in the statement for a couple of reasons we didn't, but I still think it's to a degree, it points to forces that can seem like they're at odds. And the statement was basically saying that music is a powerful vehicle for connection, for humans to connect from one to another, or from group to group or whatever. We all know this is one of the things that singing and music does. But it also has this powerful potential and power and expressiveness as an identity expressor. And those things shouldn't be at odds, but they need to be aware of each other. And sometimes the scales might tip more towards one side, towards somebody really saying, this is expressing me. Let me do this, or let me do this at least until I tell you it's okay, and I'll let you in and you can share. So I think it's around sensitivity that we're learning. It's around clarifying what the mission is. I don't think it's changing it, but it's refining it.
So Roomful of Teeth is in Boston this week because you're performing Triptych, which centers around the photography and life of Robert Mapplethorpe. Photographs of his are going to appear behind the singers, and excerpts of poetry by artists like Patti Smith will be read. This is one of a really multifaceted performance, poetry, visuals, music. Does this feel like a natural kind of fit for Roomful of Teeth?
Oh, yes. It's a really wonderful world to be in the midst of. It's the kind of thing that we've wanted to move into for a number of years, which is collaborations with other artists and other art forms. Here we have this amazing photography that's so beautifully displayed in coordination with this great music that Bryce Dessner wrote. It's a real treat.
Brad Wells is the founder and artistic director of Roomful of Teeth. He also teaches at Williams College. Roomful of Teeth is part of the multimedia performance in tribute to Robert Mapplethorpe, Triptych, Eyes of One on Another, presented by the celebrity series of Boston and Arts Emerson, which will be performed through Sunday. You can find more information and a list of music heard in this segment on our website at radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director with help from Max Liebman today. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.